This was one of the commission's most audacious omissions, because according to the official story, Building 7 demonstrated for the first time in history that fire alone could bring down a large steel frame building. So this would have meant that building codes around the world needed to be modified, and insurance premiums would have to be greatly increased. And yet the 9/11 Commission could not find one sentence in its 571-page report to mention this unprecedented event that should have changed all of those things. Yet another reason why the collapse of Building 7 is especially problematic is that it was even more similar to the best-known type of conventional demolition, which is an implosion that begins at the bottom. As Eric Hufschmidt has written, Building 7 collapsed at the bottom. The interior fell first. The result was a very tiny pile of rubble, with the outside of the building collapsing on top of the pile. The fact that Building 7 looked just like this kind of conventional demolition was, of course, noticed even by non-professionals, such as Dan Rather, who that evening on the news showed a video of the collapse of Building 7 and said, "It was reminiscent of those pictures we've all seen too much on television before, when a building was deliberately destroyed by a well-placed dynamite to knock it down." To my knowledge, Dan Rather never repeated that statement, and I also think they have not shown Building 7 on mainstream television, have not shown the collapse since then. Furthermore, a website from about the demolition industry called Implosion World, you can look this up on Google and read this for yourself, says that an implosion is by far the trickiest type of explosive project, and there are only a handful of blasting companies in the world that possess enough experience to perform these true building implosions. Can anyone really believe that fire would have just happened to perfectly mimic the kind of collapse that only a few companies in the world can produce after much planning? The building had 24 core columns and 57 perimeter columns. To hold that fire caused this building to collapse straight down in a perfectly symmetrical way would mean believing that the fire caused all 87 columns to collapse simultaneously. To believe the official story is, therefore, again, to believe in a miracle. Another reason why the collapse of Building 7 creates special problems involves foreknowledge of the collapse. We know of only a few people who had foreknowledge of the collapse of the towers. And what we have, the information would be consistent with the view that they learned this at the last minute. Maybe they saw the beginnings of some collapse and rushed out to warn Mayor Giuliani and others about this. But the foreknowledge of Building 7's collapse was much more widespread and also of much longer duration. This fact has been known for a long time, at least by people who read firefighters' magazines. But now the oral histories have provided a much fuller picture. At least 25 of the firefighters and medical workers reported that at some time that day, they learned that Building 7 was going to collapse. Firefighters who had been fighting fire in the building were pulled out early and told to leave the building, and then a collapse zone was established. As medical worker DeCosta Wright put it, they measured out how far the building was going to come, so we knew exactly where we could stand, which was five blocks away. As to exactly when this knowledge or this warning about the collapse started to circulate, testimonies differ. But most of the evidence suggests that this expectation arose about 4 to 5 hours prior to the collapse. But why would this expectation have risen? The fires in Building 7 were, as we said, according to all the photographic evidence, very small and few. So why would the decision makers in the department have decided to pull firefighters out of Building 7 and have them simply stand around waiting for the building to collapse? The chiefs gave a twofold explanation: damage plus fire. One chief said, when the North Tower fell, It ripped steel out from between the third and sixth floors across the facade on Vesey Street. We were concerned that the fires on several floors and the missing steel would result in building collapsing. Another chief spoke of damage and very heavy fire on many floors. But if there was very heavy fire on many floors and a four-story hole in the facade, why were these facts not captured on film? Also, the official line about Building 7 is contradicted by some of the oral testimonies. For example, DaCosta Wright said, "I think the fourth floor was on fire. We were like, are you guys going to put that fire out?" Chief Thomas McCarthy said, "They were waiting for World Trade 7 to come down. They had fire on three separate floors. It looked like just burning merrily. It's pretty amazing, you know. It's the afternoon in Lower Manhattan. A major high-rise is burning," and they said, "We know." Moreover, even if the department's official story about the collapse of Building 7 were not contradicted by physical evidence and some of the oral histories, it would not explain why the building collapsed, because no amount of fire and structural damage had ever caused the total collapse of a large steel frame building. It would certainly not explain the particular nature of the collapse. Again, straight down, virtually free fall speed, the tremendous amount of dust, and the other features. The extreme difficulty that the collapse of Building 7 presents for the official theory is illustrated by a recent book, 102 Minutes, one of the authors of which is reporter, New York Times reporter Jim Dwyer, who wrote the stories in the Times about the release of the 9/11 oral histories. With regard to the Twin Towers, Dwyer and his co-author Kevin Flynn support the official theory put out by NIST, according to which the towers collapsed because the airplanes knocked the fireproofing off the steel columns. But when Dwyer and Flynn come to building number 7, they offer no explanation as to why it collapsed. They simply say, "The fire department decided to allow the fire to burn itself out." But of course, that's not what happened. At about 5:30 that afternoon, the building came down, started with a sudden onset of a collapse, and came straight down at virtually free fall speed, 6.3 seconds. Should this fact not have caused Dwyer and Flynn to question NIST's theory that the towers collapse because the planes knocked their fireproofing off, given the fact that the collapse of Building 7 and the collapse of the Twin Towers, despite a few differences, were essentially the same? I would especially think that Dwyer, who reported on the release of the 9/11 oral histories, should readdress NIST's theory in light of the abundant evidence of explosives in the tower provided by these oral histories. There is, in any case, one theory, and probably only one theory, that explains both the nature and the expectation of the collapse of Building 7. Explosives had been set, and someone who knew this spread the word to the fire chiefs. Amazingly enough, a version of this theory was publicly stated by one insider, Larry Silverstein, who owned Building 7. In a PBS documentary aired in September of 2002, Silverstein, discussing Building 7, said, "I remember getting a call from the fire department commander telling me that they were not sure they were going to be able to contain the fire, and I said, 'We've had such terrible loss of fire, maybe the smartest thing to do is pull it,' and they made the decision to pull, and we watched the building collapse." It is very puzzling to be sure that Silverstein, who was ready to receive billions of dollars in payments from the insurance companies on the assumption that the buildings were brought down by alien terrorists, would have made such a statement, especially with the cameras running. But whatever his motives, his statement as to how Building 7 came down is the only plausible explanation. But we still have the question of why the fire department came to expect Building 7 to collapse. It would be interesting, of course, if that information came from the same agency, the Office of Emergency Management, that had earlier informed the department that one of the towers was going to collapse. And we have it on good authority that it did. Captain Michael Currid, the president of the Uniformed Fire Officers Association, said that sometime after the collapse of the Twin Towers, someone from the city's Office of Emergency Management told him that Building 7 was basically a lost cause and we should not lose anyone else trying to save it, after which the firefighters in the building were told to get out. However, that answer, assuming it to be correct, leaves us with more questions, beginning with who in the Office of Emergency Management knew in advance that the buildings were going to collapse? How did they know this? And so on. These questions could be answered only by a real investigation. And of course, the 9/11 Commission was not a real investigation. It was conducted by Philip Zelikow. He was the executive director. He was the one who was in charge of the staff of about 80 people. They are the ones who did all the work, not the commissioners you saw on TV. The commissioners just took what the staff gave them. Zelikow decided what topics were to be investigated, which ones not. He would have been in charge of the final draft of the report, which things go in, which things are deleted. Philip Zelikow was essentially a member of the Bush administration. He had been a member of the Bush 1 administration, working with Condoleezza Rice in the National Security Council. Then when the Republicans were out of office during the Clinton years, they wrote a book together. Then when she was named National Security Advisor for the Bush 2 administration, she brought him in to help with the transition. And now she has pulled him into the State Department. So the idea that has been suggested that we need a Katrina Commission that is an independent commission, like the 9/11 Commission, is ridiculous. The 9/11 Commission was no more independent than if Dick Cheney had been running it. So, there are lots of questions we do not have answers to, and we will probably only get answers if we get a real investigation. But it is now already possible to know, beyond a reasonable doubt, one very important thing. The destruction of the World Trade Center was an inside job, orchestrated by terrorists within our own government. Foreign terrorists could not have gotten access to the towers for the dozens or hundreds of hours it would have taken to place the explosives. Also, foreign terrorists probably would not have had the courtesy to make sure that the buildings came straight down. And they could not have orchestrated a cover-up, from the quick disposal of the steel, to the FEMA report, to the 9/11 Commission report, and now to the NIST report. All of these things had to be orchestrated by forces within our own government. The evidence for this conclusion has thus far largely been ignored by the mainstream press, perhaps under the guise of obeying President Bush's advice not to tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories. We have seen, however, that it is the Bush administration's theory that is outrageous, because it is violently contradicted by numerous facts, including some very basic laws of physics. There is, however, another reason, of course, why the press has not pointed out the contradictions. As a recent letter to the Los Angeles Times said, the number of contradictions in the official version of 9/11 is so overwhelming that it simply cannot be believed. Yet the official version cannot be abandoned because the implication of rejecting it is far too disturbing, that we are subject to a government conspiracy of X-Files proportions and insidiousness. The implications are indeed disturbing. Many people who know or at least suspect the truth about 9/11 probably believe that revealing it would be too disturbing to the American psyche, the American form of government, and global stability, so that it is better at least to pretend to believe the official narrative. But I would suggest that any merit this argument might have had at one time has been overcome by recent events and revelations. Far more devastating to the American psyche, the American form of government, and global stability will be the continued rule of those who brought us 9/11. Because the values reflected in that horrendous event have been reflected in the Bush administration's lies to justify the attack on Iraq, its disregard for environmental science and the Bill of Rights, It's criminal negligence both before and after Katrina. And now its apparent plan not only to weaponize space, but also to authorize the first use of nuclear weapons, perhaps from space. In light of this situation and the facts discussed in this lecture, as well as dozens of more problems that I and others have discussed elsewhere, I call on the New York Times to take the lead in finally exposing to the American people and the world the truth about 9/11. Taking the lead on such a story will, of course, involve risks. But if there is any news organization with the power, the prestige, and the credibility to break this story, it is the Times. It performed yeoman service in getting the 9/11 oral histories released, and we should congratulate them for that achievement. But now the welfare of our republic, and perhaps even the survival of our civilization, depend on getting the truth about 9/11 exposed. I'm calling on the Times to rise to the occasion. But the Times... But the Times and the press in general are much more likely to act if there is a widespread movement demanding the truth about 9/11. So I call on citizens who are hearing these words to form or join such a movement. And finally, as a Christian theologian, I call on fellow Christians because our religion started as an anti-imperial religion. Jesus was crucified. That is a Roman Empire form of disposal. This, if anybody is unsure about this, read Richard Horsley's book, Jesus and Empire. He makes very clear that Jesus' message was an anti-imperial, anti-Roman Empire message. So I call on fellow Christians and fellow religious people of all sorts and fellow morally concerned citizens of all types to join this movement and make it impossible to continue to conceal the truth. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
You've been listening to a presentation by David Ray Griffin, Professor Emeritus of Theology at Claremont College, given October 15th, 2005 in New York City. We continue as Professor Griffin answers questions from the audience.
Dr. Griffin, how do you counter the attack pieces by Popular Mechanics and Scientific American that have made it their business to try to say, no, the mainstream thesis is okay? Because their theses say that, you know what, it's not just temperature. Anyone know what Boyle's Law is from physics? Right. So it's not just temperature can massively heighten if the pressure differentials are different than atmospheric pressure, which is one of their arguments. They're saying, well, it wasn't atmospheric pressure in the Twin Towers. It was pressure such that the temperatures were actually higher.
My talk was heavily dependent on the work of Jim Hoffman. For example, his critique of the NIST report, which you can find if you just go on Google and go under Mirage, because his that's central term in the title. Well, Jim had earlier written a critique of the Popular Mechanics piece and also the Scientific American piece. So the short answer is you can find devastating critiques of both of those things by Jim Hoffman. It gets pretty complex, but the Popular Mechanics piece is really just really a joke. Worse yet is the fact that Scientific American, which has been a very reputable publication, Popular Mechanics was too at one time, but they recently had a complete change of their staff. So these were not the same people, if you used to read Popular Mechanics, that put this out. I'll just refer to that rather than trying to go into any details about that.
Okay, this is another physics type question. Please address the production of dust from the sheer pressure of concrete and steel falling on other debris. And does this bolster the official theory? Any other thoughts on horizontal dust?
Yeah. Well, the production of dust itself, we're really talking about extremely fine powder. You know, I forget now Hoffman's estimate of how many microns this was, but it's very tiny. You know, you could take a sledgehammer and take a piece of concrete and smash it for an hour. you would not produce the kind of very fine powder that was produced here. And we're talking about, you know, thousands of tons of concrete, all of it pulverized. And remember, this isn't just Hoffman and 9/11 people. This was this person from the Army Corps of Engineers said virtually everything is pulverized. So we're talking about desks, computers, everything non-metallic. All of that stuff was turned into very fine powder. That by itself refutes the official theory. Each one of these points by itself refutes the official theory. And yet if you want to think, well, maybe just somehow one of them could have happened accidentally or just coincidentally, to take all 10 of them, you're talking about extremely remote odds.
Speculate on the psychological resistance that many Americans, including leftist intellectuals, people who claim to be anti-establishment, like Chomsky, Amy Goodman, and et al., have in facing the facts of 9/11 truth.
We could focus on the glass being half full, and we do have a number of leading left-leaning intellectuals who are on board now. So Marcus Raskin, for example, Rosemary Ruther, John McMurtry, Michelle Chosudowski, and some others. We've got a book coming out pretty soon, by the way, and this point that Les made about this is no longer a fringe movement. I and Peter Dale Scott are in co-editing a volume called 9/11 and the American Empire, Intellectuals Speak Out, and we have a dozen well-respected intellectuals who are going to speak out on this. And there's going to be a companion volume called 9/11 and the American Empire, Christians, Jews, and Muslims Speak Out. And so we will show that Christians and Jews are united with Muslims on this issue. With regard to the resistance of some of the left, partly this is an a priori matter where they have a conviction that there is a contradiction in principle between what they call structural analysis and then conspiratorial analysis. And I'm absolutely with them on the necessity for structural analysis of the problems of our country and the problems of the world. It's not just a few bad apples and we get rid of them, then everything would be fine. And that seems to be their attitude, that conspiratorial analysis, they believe, is individualistic analysis. And so it's saying, well, you've got a few bad guys in there. If we could just get rid of Cheney and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and Pearl and get them out of the government, then everything would be fine. And, of course, that's ridiculous. But they think in terms of that antithesis, and some of them are so convinced that they wouldn't need to pull off this kind of conspiracy that they literally refuse to look at the evidence. So some of these people have said, no, I simply will not read Griffin's book or, you know, any of the other books around because they know a priori that it doesn't make sense. So it's a very difficult thing to crack. But I actually don't worry about it too much. If we didn't have any left-leaning intellectuals, then that would be a problem. But we do have some very important and leading lights. And I didn't even mention Howard Zinn a minute ago. And so it's not an overwhelming problem. Our problem really is to reach the masses of the American people and to reach the media. And there are some signs. And it's very hopeful now. I'm more hopeful now than I've ever been just in the last few months. I've been contacted by three mainstream media organizations who are open to hearing and reporting the truth about this. Now, whether the higher ups in the organization will allow these reporters to get the story out is another question, but at least we have some people inside who do know the story and want to report the story. So the 9/11 truth movement has made a difference, and we should not give up and despair. These things do take time.
Okay, a little bit off the topic, but do you know anything about the failure of NORAD and the fiasco of the air defense activity and their failure to intercept the hijacked planes, if they were coming from the ones that were coming from Boston Airport?
Yeah, I know a little bit about this. I've been giving two lectures on this trip, and my other lecture is called Flights 11, 175, 77, and 93, the 9/11 Commission's New Tale. This is something in itself that the mainstream press has not informed the American people of, that we've been given three stories now. And, you know, if somebody's accused of, robbing the bank, and you go to Jones and you say, we think you probably robbed the bank. Where were you on Friday night? And Jones says, oh, I was at the movies. I say, the movie theater was closed Friday night. Oh, that's right, I was with my girlfriend. No, we checked with your girlfriend, and she was home with her husband. And so then he says, oh, that's right, I was home reading my Bible. You're probably not going to believe him. And yet, that's the situation we face. Right after 9/11, the military told us, Richard Myers, acting head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Mike Snyder, the spokesman for NORAD, both independently said, we didn't send up any planes until after the Pentagon was hit. So that means almost an hour and a half went by after the time that there were danger signs with Flight 11 that should have triggered this standard operating procedure where the FAA contacts NORAD and then NORAD has planes scrambled. And by their own testimony, they say that we're able to scramble planes to anywhere in the country within a matter of minutes. And here we're talking about a matter of an hour and 30 minutes almost. So some people then started talking about stand down. That looks like stand down. So very quickly, a news story was came out. So CBS News on Friday said, contrary to earlier reports, planes were sent up, but they just didn't get there in time because the FAA was too late in notifying NORAD. Well, then some early 9/11 researchers, and by the way, I'm a Johnny-come-lately to this movement. It took me a long time to get on board, about a year and a half. But you had some people who started from day one. And some of them did the math and looked at those timelines. This was the timeline put out by NORAD on September 18th, 2001. They looked at the timeline and said, you know, you might have made it for Flight 11 to prevent the attack on the North Tower. You clearly could have made it with Flight 175 because you had 20 minutes according to your own timeline. With Flight 77, you had plenty of time because you were notified at 9:24, you said. You sent the scramble order at 9:24, and the Pentagon wasn't hit till 9:38. You had lots of time. And so the 9/11 Commission then says that was all incorrect. Is that not incredible? The official story that we have literally had thousands of reports around the world based on that story, that was the official story for about 2.5 years. And the 9/11 Commission report says, no, that was all incorrect. And even Larry Arnold, who was the head of the Continental Region of NORAD, testified to the Commission in 2003, yes, we were notified about Flight 77 at 9:24 that morning. And some other NORAD officials testified, and that's why the planes were scrambled and took off at 9:30. Well, the news story is that the FAA never notified NORAD about Flight 175 until it crashed into the South Tower, never notified it about Flight 77, so they didn't know about it until after the Pentagon was hit. And so then they have to make up a new story, that's my interpretation, but that's what it looks like, about Phantom Flight 11. They say that somebody at Boston FAA said, oh, Flight 11 didn't actually hit the North Tower. It's still up and headed towards Washington. and told that to a needs technician, you know, NORAD in the northeast section, needs technician. That technician told the mission commander, who then scrambled the airplanes, and that's why the planes went off at 9:30, not because what Arnold said and NORAD said, because we've been notified about Flight 77. So it's just as absurd as the story about the towers. So again, I stress this point. No matter which part of the story you look into and go into it in depth, it just makes no sense at all. And yet the mainstream press thus far has not informed the American people about any of these things.
Isn't that where that Cheney factor possibly could come in, those so-called simulated hijackings that were reported by Mr. Rupert? Could that possibly have been a factor in what you're talking about?
This is a very good question, the question about the war games, and it's something I'm not expert on. I've read quite a bit about it, but it's not something I've formed any clear theory on. It's certainly highly suspicious that there were... Now, Rupert had reported on 4 war games. Now, Matt Everett and Paul Thompson have said there seem to be far more than that. So this is certainly highly suspicious. But what role the war games played on 9/11, I don't have a theory about that. It's very suspicious. It certainly looks clear. It seems clear that Cheney was in charge that day. And here's another example of the outrageous lies in the 9/11 Commission report. Norman Mineta, Secretary of Transportation, testified in an open hearing to the 9/11 Commission, so it's part of the official record, that when he went downstairs that morning to the underground shelter under the White House, the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, he got there at 9:20, and Cheney was already there and fully in charge. And clearly he had been engaged in an ongoing conversation, so that Cheney had to have gotten there about 9:15, which fits exactly with what Richard Clark says in his book, Against All Enemies, and actually fits with what Dick Cheney himself had said to Tim Russert. And yet the 9/11 Commission says Cheney didn't get to the underground shelter until almost 10 o'clock, probably 9:58. So they changed the record by almost 45 minutes. And why? Because everybody knows that Cheney's the one who gave the shoot-down order, and Flight 93 crashed in Pennsylvania at 10:03, at least according to the commission. And they argue that they ignore all the evidence that Flight 93 was shot down by our own military. Considerable evidence. They just ignore it all. And this a priori argument, they couldn't have possibly shot it down because Cheney didn't give the shoot down order until between 10:10 and 10:15. So obviously Flight 93 had already crashed. The military wouldn't have shot it down on its own, and so we can just ignore all the evidence that it was shot down. So they were willing to tell such an audacious lie that contradicts every prior story about that, to evidently cover up the fact that Cheney was in charge long before and calling the shots.
Okay, there's a ammunition for the mainstream thesis. What exactly did Mr. Silverstein mean when he said, quote-unquote, pull it when referring to Building 7? What made him think that he could pull it? Is it not possible that even large buildings can be rigged for pulling, terrorism notwithstanding? In other words, is it possible that sometimes in the recent past plans were made for large buildings to be made to implode in the event of some kind of doomsday scenario with neither the approved or even the notification of the citizenry? So that's an alternative hypothesis as to why there would be rigged explosions.
Yeah. Well, not necessarily an alternative. Certainly, the building had to have been already rigged. They couldn't have done this in about 4 hours there. And I understand it is the case now that with new buildings, the wiring is sometimes already put in so that later, if you decided you wanted to bring the building down, it's very common the buildings, for one reason or another, they want to bring them down. So it's much cheaper to put the wiring in at advance, and that's the big job. And then the matter of attaching the explosives could be done relatively quickly, but not in 4 hours. So certainly it had to be all done in advance. So I didn't mean to suggest that Silverstein's statement was a true statement about the sequence of events, but simply a true statement about how the building came down, that is, that that it was pulled. Now, on that particular PBS video, the word pull is used in another place there and clearly means bringing down with controlled demolition. There are some people who've tried to argue that by pull, he meant, oh, we decided to pull the firefighters out of the building. But if you remember, I read the statement. He said, and we made the decision to pull, and we watched the building collapse. It seems absolutely clear that, that's what he meant. I'm as mystified as anyone as to why he would have said that, particularly with the cameras on. Some people have some theories about this, that it was kind of a limited hangout. I haven't seen any theory that I thought made sense, but it is a fact that he said it. You can go on Google and look under Silverstein, and you can hear those words yourself.
There's a note, along the physical evidence arguments, hole in the Pentagon, big question mark. Okay. This is an allusion to the fact that, in my opinion, and probably in the opinion of Dr. Griffin, there's no way an aircraft hit, passenger aircraft hit the Pentagon based on the physical evidence. Question mark, anti-aircraft guns at the Pentagon. The follow-up question, what do you think will happen to this country if the 9/11 truth thesis becomes popularized? Will there be mass chaos? Will the country disintegrate? Is there any kind of mechanism in place to bring people, these folks, to justice?
I gather that was a two-part question. And the latter question is so huge. I mean, I have no idea. But I am certainly convinced that we will be, whatever dislocation, to use that antiseptic term, whatever dislocation is caused, it will be better for us to know the truth and to... and to root out the cancer rather than to let it keep going. Some of you are aware that there have been previous big operations that they got away with. And there were people at that time saying, if they get away with that, then they'll do it again. And it seems that that's true. Well, if they get away with this one, where the evidence is so clear, I mean... The evidence is clear on the other big one now. I mean, it's just absolutely overwhelming. I'm talking about the JFK assassination. But it took years to get the really definitive evidence that we now have. But now the evidence is already so strong about 9/11 that if they get away with this, which means the media has to continue to be complicit with this, then they'll be emboldened to say we can get away with anything. Now, with regard to the Pentagon, a question came up yesterday about the divisiveness in the 9/11 movement. And I've heard rumors that there have been a few debates with a little acrimony here and there. And I suggested that I was asked what I thought about what we could do about that. And I suggested that I think it would be helpful if we focused on the evidence that the official story is false, and therefore the fact that we need a real investigation, and not worry so much about trying to develop a definitive theory about what happened that day. Almost all the acrimony is about this. My theory is correct, and you're denying it, and therefore you're a disinformation agent, or something to that effect. And we get those mutual charges. A lot of these things we just don't know, and we won't know until we have that real investigation and get some people to talk who do know. You know, we may be strongly convinced of the truth of our position. That is different than knowing. Knowing means absolute, that it's true, and you're justified, absolutely justified in believing that it's true. That's the, you know, regular definition of knowledge. So to be a little humble and pull back from claims that are controversial within the movement itself. So, for example, with the Pentagon, rather than saying absolutely that we know that that wasn't an airliner, I mean, I think the evidence is fairly strong that it wasn't. But there are people in the movement, reasonable people, who argue otherwise. And when some of us say, well, the hole appears to be too small, they say, well, the hole's covered up by the water from the fire hoses. Well, I don't believe it, but I don't know that they're false. I don't know that they're wrong about that. And so I have drawn back then to the claim that I am very certain about, which is that the official account is false. The official account being that it was Flight 77 under the control of Hani Hanjour that crashed into the Pentagon. That we know it cannot be true, because Hani Hanjour, from all the evidence, even the 9/11 Commission admits it, could not fly even a Cessna, let alone a Boeing 767. And we've also got very good evidence, I mean reason to believe, these brilliant hijackers who were so bright to out-trick our air defense system would have known that the west wing of the Pentagon was the worst place to strike. The east wing is where they would have struck, or they would have gone into the roof of the east wing and not done that fantastic loop down that could have failed, coming in at ground level, only to hit the west wing, where there were very few people. It had been renovated, so the damage didn't go very far. And the people who were there were mainly civilians who were doing the renovation. The top brass and Rumsfeld were in the east wing. So we've got very good reason to discount the official story. And we don't need to go into the details about what really happened. You know, we can have our strong convictions, but we shouldn't read others out of the movement because they disagree with our very strong convictions.
Okay. Are there any? Do you know of any class actions that are taking place? Lawsuits against the administration. That's one. And two, any tax revolts?
Yeah, I haven't heard of any tax revolts. There are, I believe, two suits at least going on with Philip Berg, yeah. And then there's this other one I believe is still going on, but I don't know enough about it, so it wouldn't be a topic I should try to talk about.
Okay, Dr. Kriven, how did you become such an expert, and what possessed you to delve into this topic?
I'm a pretty good reader, is how I became sort of an expert. And I say that somewhat facetiously because people say, well, you know, I mean, you're a theologian, you're not an architect or an engineer or a physicist. Well, you don't need to be an expert on these things. You need to know how to read. There's a little more to that. You know how to read and evaluate arguments and learn who are credible authorities and who isn't and think logically. So, you know, philosophical theological background is actually a pretty good one for getting into this. I got into it, as I mentioned, Johnny Come Lately. You know, when it first occurred, I thought, you know, that looks a little suspicious, but I didn't think much about it. About a year later, a fellow theologian said, well, you know, it was an inside job. And I said, okay, that's interesting, what's the evidence? And he told me about a website, and I looked at it, and I didn't find it convincing. I don't remember what website it is, so I'm not saying any particular one. Wasn't very good. And then a few months later, another academic sent me a website that had Paul Thompson's 200-page single-space timeline on there that now has been published as the Terra Timeline, or a lot of it has. And I looked at that and saw within a few hours of reading that, that there were just literally hundreds of stories from mainstream sources, strictly mainstream sources, that contradicted the official story. But most of them got published only once or twice at most. They didn't have legs. Nobody else would pick up that story. And so that in itself was suspicious. So I got into it that way, and one thing led to another. I was going to write an article, and the article got very long, so I decided I'd go ahead and write a book. As my wife can tell you, it's been a sort of 24/7 since then. I mean, an enormous amount of time goes into sorting out the different theories and the evidence. As far as just getting the basics, if some of you here are new to this, it really doesn't take that long. You really just need to read, say my two books. By the way, I had the greatest compliment I had from a woman who was standing over here, and I don't know if she's still here, but she said, "I didn't want you to convince me, but you did."
This is going to be the last question. This is more of a technical question. Essentially, it talks about how the architectural immensity of the World Trade Center and how it could have been wired and how the controls could have been set, and any ideas when they could have happened or similar to that nature.
Well, I had reported in there the statement by Scott Forbes, who said that the South Tower, which he worked in, was shut down there for a while. So I was suggesting that might have been part of the time when this final work of setting the explosives was done. I have no idea whether when the Twin Towers were built, they were originally wired for this sort of thing. You know, one of the suspicious things is we're not allowed to see the blueprints for the buildings. And you would think, the most horrendous event that's happened on American soil in terms of allegedly a terrorist attack, that the examination of this event would have been so meticulous, and yet every attempt was made to prevent an investigation. So most of you know the Bush and Cheney worked very hard not even to have an investigation of any sort. And then when the families finally backed them into a corner where they had to do it, they were going to point Henry Kissinger, who might not have been the most objective person. And then they actually got somebody more intimately connected, Philip Zelikow, to run the commission. And it was terribly underfunded. Compare the amount of money. You know, they keep squeezing money out, and what they finally came up with, $11 million. The Challenger investigation, I believe, was $50 million. We spent far more investigating Clinton's sex life and other Clinton scandals than on this event, which everybody agrees was the event of the 21st century. Every time the administration wants to do something new and people object, they say, "Well, you don't understand 9/11. And if other countries object, they didn't experience 9/11. So it's constantly referred to as the reason for every imperial act and every restriction of human rights, and yet we didn't want to investigate it. And we gave the commission a completely inside cover-up job. So this is one more example. Just looking at the history of the 9/11 commission shows very strong prima facie evidence that those in power did not want the truth revealed. Well, thank you very much for coming out. And thank you so much.
That was David Ray Griffin, Professor Emeritus of Theology, Claremont College, speaking October 15th in New York City. Thanks to Luke Rudkowski and New York 9/11 Truth for making this tape available. Last November, Dr. Stephen Jones, a professor of physics at Brigham Young University, caused a sensation when he gave a scholarly presentation asserting that the World Trade Center collapsed because of, quote, pre-positioned explosives. Late last month, he announced the formation of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, ST911.org, a group of more than 50 academics who issued the following statement, quote, "We believe that senior government officials have covered up crucial facts about what really happened on 9/11. We believe these events may have been orchestrated by the administration in order to manipulate the American people into supporting policies at home and abroad," close quote. On February 1st, Jones gave a two-hour audiovisual presentation at Utah Valley State College, which blogger Philip Sherman Gordon described as follows. A quiet, churchy-looking gentleman in a white shirt and tie walked into a packed auditorium and electrified the room like a rock star. The 150-seat auditorium was filled to capacity with every seat occupied, and people sitting in the aisles from the stage floor to the back of the room. Video cameras on tripods lined the back row. 7 spillover rooms, with seating for 40 to 50 each, were also filled to capacity. On this very conservative campus, in the most conservative county, in the most conservative state in the Union, where community leaders pulled out all the stops in 2004 to prevent Michael Moore from speaking, Dr. Stephen Jones, this pious professor from the Mormon Church-owned Brigham Young University, calmly, gently, gave a simple physics lesson on the collapse of the World Trade Center buildings, the implications of which awed the audience with a sense of world historical significance, and implied an indictment of the present administration so utterly devastating that it made Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 look like a Bush apologia. We'll conclude with a brief excerpt from that presentation in which Jones discusses the molten metal in the basements of all 3 buildings and the type of explosives its presence indicates. Our website, unwelcomeguest.org, will have links to his entire presentation where you can view and read his evidence in its entirety.
I would like to talk about thermite. This is a demonstration, University in California, with thermite. The reaction is iron oxide, rust, plus aluminum, powdered aluminum. If you put sulfur in, it cuts through steel faster. And you see the white-hot steel now. This reaches temperatures hot enough to evaporate steel. Does that sound familiar? Remember, evaporated steel was seen in the rubble pile. And this is the collapse of the North Tower. We see, just like you see here, this aluminum oxide coming off and the glowing hot metal. It looks like, we're trying to get more photos, but this looks like, this is a steel structure now from the North Tower. Something glowing there, and then this trailing off smoke coming off of that. It certainly looks like thermite, but there's more. There was molten metal found beneath both towers and Building 7. Now, the temperature, according to Eager and others, in these fires is about 650 centigrade. To melt steel requires 1,500. Thermite gets you up well past that, 2,500. And as you look at the molten stuff being pulled out of that, we have photographs and so on of this, but you see that you've got this yellow hot stuff. The color of the metal tells you the temperature. It's physics. So this has to be something that can hold together even when it's salmon and yellow hot. Well, what is that? Structural steel can handle that, you know, lemon and salmon temperatures, no problem. Aluminum melts at 660. If this had been aluminum, it would just be liquid. It can't be solid at those temperatures. Yes, and it was also weeks after, thank you. And after this slag solidifies, we finally got a picture of this. You see it's covered with a red, which certainly looks like rust. Again, the end product of the thermite reaction is molten iron. And you see the entrained cement and rebar here, of course. But I've had people say, well, it's just aluminum from the planes. Well, I'm sorry. First of all, there's molten metal beneath Building 7, and there was no plane there. Okay, so, and plus the fact, of course, we're building the evidence here. We're hoping to analyze some of this stuff and really nail it as, does it have high iron content and aluminum oxide as well? Explosive specialist, I have read your paper concerning the tower's collapse and agree military thermite, which is the type with sulfur as an accelerant to make it cut through steel much faster, is the only explanation for the molten slag found weeks after the collapse. Thermite charges used in conjunction with small linear charges. Now, I emphasize that. I believe that if thermite was used, there was also explosives like HDX or RDX used as well. FEMA talks about the sulfidation. This is in the FEMA report. I'm sorry. It's this Professor Barnett again. He's a good guy out in Massachusetts. He said, look, we found this steel under Building 7, And it's got sulfidation, means sulfur attacked the steel, which it does. Where'd the sulfur come from? Good question. Used in conjunction with thermite, it's called thermate. It's a military form, and it's used to cut through steel rapidly. Hot spots in the rubble corroborate the reports of the deep down molten metal, the red color, and then this is building 7. The red-orange implies these very high temperatures. This is 5 days after 9/11. There is an explosion at the base of the building. This is building 2. White smoke from the bottom. White smoke, again, consistent with thermite. Something happened. See, what you do is you want to cut those core columns, these huge steel cores, down low. And this is what the demolition expert said. If I were going to bring the towers down, I would put explosives in the basement to get the weight of the building to help collapse the structure. Gosh, that sounds just like what happened, particularly at Building 7. But, you know, the tower is also, there are reports of explosions. Now we get to a little thing that's kind of important. Here's another one of these puzzle pieces. In building 7 was the CIA's undercover New York station. And also offices of the Department of Defense and FBI. Now, this is a high-security building. It's not like you can have hijackers running in there. It's cordoned off on 9/11 and start planning explosives that day. No, or the towers either, of course. And this is a particularly high security building. Now, here's another puzzle piece, which I think will interest you. At the bottom here, I mentioned this briefly. The towers were old and loaded with asbestos. There was much discussion of how we're going to get this asbestos out of the towers or take the towers down. It was prohibitively expensive. The owner / leaseholder of these buildings insured these buildings, the World Trade Center buildings, against terrorist attack less than 2 months before 9/11. I'm not, you know, sure, but he did receive an estimated over $4 billion in insurance payment. Now, the cleanup was out of our money, taxpayers. The building of these buildings, it looks like, will be largely funded by taxpayers' money. This guy has pocketed a fair piece of change. And I would ask a few questions, you know, if I were in a position to do so. I am asking the questions. I just thought I'm, you know, not in a position to get answers under oath. Okay, anyway, it takes weeks to plan. You should know that. Not a lot of explosives, 3,000 pounds per building, but it takes weeks to plan to bring a building down like this and to plant explosives to get a building to come down in this way. Who could pull it off with the CIA, FBI, and DOD in the highly secure building? So questions naturally arise whether this was an inside job. It doesn't look like the hijackers brought the buildings down. That's what I said in my original paper. And that's just science. I mean, it's just almost inescapable. I don't see any way out of it. Scott Forbes wrote that on the weekend just prior to 9/11, there was a power down condition in Tower 2, the South Tower, for approximately 36 hours. Ben Fountain says, over the past few weeks, we've been evacuated a number of times from the World Trade Center South Tower, which is unusual. I think they had an inkling that something was going on.
That was Professor of Physics Stephen Jones of Brigham Young University, speaking February 1st in Utah. Please visit unwelcomeguests.org to download an MP3 of this program and to follow links for more information. It's up to us, folks. Another brave.